May it please the Court, I'm Frank Cordell. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Immunex Corporation. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Very well.
Your Honors, this case is a long-running insurance coverage litigation that arises out of a massive series of class actions that were brought against my client, Immunex Corporation. It's undisputed that Immunex tendered those lawsuits to its insurer, National Surety, in October of 2006. And I should say there's discussion in the brief about the contested question of whether there was an earlier tender as early as 2002. But for purposes of almost all this appeal, or I would say all, and in particular the summary judgment ruling that we are appealing, the only relevant, the first relevant piece of event is that October 2006, undisputed that, again, the company tendered those lawsuits, asked National Surety to defend. About 20 months later, in March 2008, National Surety accepted that tender under reservation of rights, and that tender letter was unambiguously promised to defend Immunex. It says if Fireman's Fund, that then called Fireman's Fund, agrees to defend Immunex until such time as it can obtain a court determination confirming its coverage decision, Fireman's Fund agrees to provide a defense even though it has not completed its investigation, because Fireman's Fund wants to be sure it has protected Immunex's interests while it pursues that investigation. The insurance company went on to ask for invoices so they could be reviewed for reasonableness and paid. The insurer reserved the right or declined to pay pre-tender, pre-October 2006 invoices because of its contention that notice and tender had been delayed, but it made no such reservation for the post-tender fees. After all that, Your Honors, you would think that those post-tender fees had been paid and as promised in the letter, but they were not. Instead, on the same, essentially the same day as sending this letter, National Surety sued Immunex, raised multiple defenses, including late notice, late tender, the known loss doctrine, and litigated for the ensuing 11 years up to and through today, attempting to pay zero in defense costs. We're here to appeal Judge Roberts' ruling that the issuance of this reservation of rights letter itself, the issuance of this piece of paper to the policyholder, promising to pay, making an unfulfilled promise to pay, is sufficient to immunize the insurance company from extra contractual liability as a matter of law. And the answer, that was error to so hold. It's error because this court and the Washington Supreme Court have developed a really detailed and robust body of law governing the liability insurer's duty to defend. And it's kind of, I would say it's actually sort of an elegant system of checks and balances, so to speak. When an insurer receives a tender of an underlying lawsuit from its policyholder, the insurer says, hey, we may have in coverage defenses to this lawsuit. This court's decisions and the Washington Supreme Court decisions tell that insurer that they can do one of two things. If they wish to contest that coverage, if they think their coverage position is strong and they don't wish to pay defense costs, they want to save those defense costs, they can deny coverage. If they deny coverage, they don't have to pay. If coverage litigation ensues, however, and it's determined that that decision was wrong, that there was a duty to defend, the penalty for trying to save those defense dollars is that the insurer is exposed to extra contractual liability, bad faith, Consumer Protection Act violations.
So are you trying to distinguish two periods of time, the pre-tender from the post-tender, in terms of those claims?
No, Your Honor. Are you
trying to assert that after the tender they were on the hook for whatever fees were incurred, regardless of the prejudice consideration?
We infer from the Supreme Court decision's case in this case that National Surety had the ability on remand to make out its late notice and prejudice case with respect to all defense fees, and that's how the case was tried on remand. Our point is a different one, which is that we do not believe that the mere issuance of a reservation of rights letter, unfulfilled promise to pay, is sufficient to immunize the insurer as a matter of law from extra contractual.
So if they had written a check for the first invoice, we wouldn't be here. There'd be no issue of on that point.
If there's this question about this raises a good your question raises a point.
I'm just watching the clock go.
I understand. We do not contend, if there's any question, that National Surety is liable for bad faith per se. We are saying that the trial court was incorrect in immunizing National Surety simply by having issued a reservation of rights letter. I say that because, Your Honor, what we wanted is an opportunity to prove to a jury that was in bad faith. That issuance of this letter and then refusal to pay anything was in bad faith.
But at the stage of the litigation, wasn't it really in the posture that this is a reimbursement claim at this point? They get the deck action, determined they don't have coverage. Now the real question is, so how much, if any, do they have to pay? Until that amount's determined, how can they act in bad faith?
Your Honor, we think there is an extensive body of case law that says in order to get that protection from bad faith, you have to defend. You have to. And the cases, Vanport, Kirk versus Mount Airy.
Well, I understand, but the tender didn't allow them to defend most of the litigation.
But, Your Honor, they made a distinction between pre- and post-tender, but they agreed to pay post-tender, and they didn't. And that's what we contend we should have had the opportunity to prove was unreasonable and in bad faith. And I may be missing your question, no. But you're right. This case is a little strange because it came
up. It's bad faith not to pay us immediately and then ask us to reimburse.
We'd say
refund later.
Even more broadly, I would say the case law tells us it's bad faith to guess incorrectly that you to deny defense coverage and not pay and then have it be determined later that there was a duty to defend. And granted, we recovered less from the jury than we would have liked to, but the jury found there were defense fees owed. I'll preserve the rest of time. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Bob Salkin. I represent National Surety. It's actually worse than it is portrayed by my friend, Mr. Cordell. What happened was there was a reservation of rights letter put in. We said, send us the bills. We'll pay. And they don't send us the bills until after the litigation is complete. And the reason they didn't, and it's in their complaint, their counterclaims don't get you to the sites, was that they wanted to negotiate with National Surety a confidentiality provision, which is just a delay tactic to keep their lawyers in place. And that's at CP 1560, which is on their, which is part of the their counterclaim. In fact, in their counterclaims, the very counterclaims we're talking about, they list the items of bad faith at CP 1562. They don't list this issue as an issue of bad faith. In fact, they told the trial court that the reason they weren't paid immediately was because of this very issue. I cite to a declaration of Matthew Seckett's at 11 CP 1170, page 1173, is a letter from Dick Steen Shapiro, which says, as we have stated, once the agreement is signed, Immunex can finally commence forwarding attorney's bills. That's dated April 28, 2009. Coincidentally, the bills weren't sent to us until after May 29, 2009. And when is the last invoice date of all the bills? May 29, 2009. That's it. Exhibit 304A and 304B. There never was an issue on us not paying. Let's just start there. In fact, at trial, Mr. Brown, the claims adjuster, was put on the stand by us, and he was taken through his reservation of rights letter and questioned. You said you'd pay. Yes. You said you wanted to, quote, FFIC, that's National Surety, wants to be sure it has protected Immunex's interest while it pursues the investigation. And at Records of Proceeding 58, this is the question that was asked by us. Mr. Brown, do you know how long it took Immunex to send its bills to you after this request? Objection. by Immunex. They didn't want the jury to know that. And in fact, the objection, going from 50, record proceedings 58 to 62, was sustained. It's irrelevant. And so what you have here really is two things going on at the same time. You have the progeny of ALEA decisions, which says that once an insurer issues a reservation of rights, it has a duty to step in and defend. Overlaid with that was this second issue, which none of the cases they cite focuses on, which is what happens when you issue a reservation of rights, but there's late notice that may cause prejudice. And what the courts have said, or at least the court in this very case has said, is, look, you don't lose your right, that is the insurance company, to claim and prove actual prejudice by issuing the reservation of rights letter, which is precisely what happened here. We go to the jury, and the jury found for us, quite frankly. And in fact, if you look at the closing arguments, there was no argument made by Immunex that at a minimum they issued a reservation of rights and you, that is the jury, should ask Immunex or award to Immunex the amount of fees from that point forward. They never argued that. One, they couldn't because of reasons I stated, but there was another reason for that. They made a tactical decision, up to them, to go for the whole enchilada. They didn't want the fees between April, whenever the reservation of rights letter was in 2008 forward. They wanted everything. They wanted $15-plus million in fees, and they bet the farm on it, and they lost. And what they did was they bet the farm by claiming, not what Mr. Cordell said this morning, that the tender was in October of 2006, but in fact there was a tender in January of 2002. And that was, quite frankly, completely unsupportable. As we point out in our brief, their own general counsel admitted that there was no tender in January 2002. Dave Berman, a highly respected lawyer at Perkins Coie, admitted he wasn't working for the insurance company, wasn't sending his bills there because he didn't think there was a tender. There just wasn't any tender. So what happens? During the course of this, they give us false information on whether or not, as you recall, there are two coverages, A and B. Under A, we follow form. They told us they never made claims on another insurer. That turned out to be false. But the fact of the matter is, we did issue a reservation of rights. We did offer to pay immediately without waiving our right to get the money back. They never sent us a bill until after litigation was over, and they knew it. They never sued us for that. They never wanted testimony about it. They put evidence before the trial court that we did nothing wrong through this negotiation. They never claimed we were stalling this negotiation to not pay. None of that. And as I said, they didn't sue us for bad faith for not paying immediately. Instead, they bet the farm. Didn't turn out as they had hoped. And now they want to sort of carve back and have another shot at an issue they don't deserve a shot at.
Is there a way to reverse engineer how the jury came up with $670,000?
There are ways of doing it, yes.
Does it correspond with a specific invoice and not others?
Well,
not others?
Here's what I did in closing. What I argued was, look, we argued if you believe that initially in 2002 had they tendered, we would have issued no reservation of rights, but instead just filed a deck action. Because remember, we didn't have any reason to issue a reservation of rights because we didn't have a Kornfeld's letter claiming there's any coverage. If you believe that, the number is zero. On the other hand, jury, if you believe we would have issued a reservation of rights, then the question is, what is the date you believe we'd have issued by, and when do you think the court would have issued its ruling? I think I said 18 months, which was the time that actually happened. And what we had was a chart of the invoices. And I just said, pick your number. If you think it's here, I think he said it's $2 million. If you think it's here, it's here. And so, yes, the jury didn't just pick. We gave them the invoices. They had them all. The other issue that's overlaying this is, which means there may not be exactitude, is the following. Dave Berman, who's a terrific lawyer, but his billing rate was 29% higher than someone comparable, Steve Rummage, their own expert. We claimed we would not have hired Berman. And in fact, Dave said, I wouldn't have done the work for the insurance company. I don't like working for him. So we claimed, one, there would have been a reduction in bills of about 29%, at least as to Berman and as to the other associates. And two, if you look at the bills, and I think the trial exhibit 116 and 270, the Perkins bills, they're just massive block billing. I mean, it's just massive. And I'm, just to be clear, I'm not arguing that they didn't do the work. There was one instance that came up and the like. What I am saying is an insurance company just doesn't permit it. And the block billing doesn't allow them to analyze the issue. We called an expert witness who testified he thought the bills were high, Jim Smith. And so the jury was given latitude within the invoices. Last point, it wasn't raised by Mr. Cordell on the issue of a duty to investigate. We did not have a duty to investigate until there was a tender. And that's just the case law. The court allowed evidence into trial about our claims handling, mistakes we made. They had two experts on the subject, Mr. Miller and Mr. Smith. Now, did they get in all the evidence they want? No. I think the judge was right, but clearly it was harmless error given the jury's decision, because what they were doing was hand in glove, saying tender was in January of 2002, and you failed to investigate in January of 2002, and had you, things would have been different. So unless you have any other questions, I ask the court to affirm the jury verdict. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, my friend Mr. Sulkin is a wonderful trial lawyer, but we're not today in a trial court, and I would suggest that most of that argument would be the kind of factual argument that we thought we should have had in terms of whether National Surety had acted unreasonably and was in bad faith. Please remind the court that what we're appealing here is a summary judgment ruling that had nothing to do with all the extreme detail that Mr. Sulkin went through. It was a ruling that, as a matter of law, the issuance of the reservation of rights without payment immunized the insurer from bad faith liability. And I have to emphasize, it's rare that I'm before this court or any court with a case that can be so important and so radically changed Washington insurance law. Think about the implications if the Superior Court's summary judgment ruling is affirmed. No economically rational insurer presented with potential coverage defenses and a tender would choose to defend. Because if they defend, they know under the Supreme Court's decision in this case that they cannot recoup those defense costs. Those costs are gone, so they might as well do what National Surety did here, send a reservation of rights letter. They know they're protected from extra contractual liability. In due course, that policyholder may or may not have the wherewithal to sue. They may or may not win. And if the policyholder does win, all the insurer is out is the same cost that they would have spent anyway, with potential prejudgment interest would be the only sweetener.
But aren't the facts here more limited than a general rule that every time there's a tender, they don't have to pay and there's no bad faith?
Oh, Your Honor, I would respectfully no. I don't see how this court can issue a ruling that is case fact specific or that goes.
Summary judgment's fact specific.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think that was not how it was argued by National Surety, nor was that the basis of the court's ruling. It was in the court's view a clean matter. A legal determination that the act of issuing a reservation of rights letter immunized them from any extra contractual liability. And that's
wouldn't the insurer have to manufacture a late tender, though, to make your scenario work?
Well, no, Your Honor, there's nothing specific about, again, the court's summary judgment ruling, the legal principle that Judge Roberts applied there. There's nothing specific to notice. I mean, you can look in the briefs and look in the ruling. As I sit here, I can't think of what a principled way to limit it to that defense. We're simply saying, Your Honor, they're not immunized. We should have the ability to come back to the trial court and prove that the conduct was unreasonable. Thank you very much.
Thank you.